Thank you very much. In April of 1967, my father, who was an economist like myself, found it to be his duty to speak and act against the destruction of democracy in Greece and in solidarity with the people of Greece at that time. I won't repeat the details. They were well known, and I suspect quite a few of those who are here remember them. But I will say that today, my most precious possession in my library is a book. It is a copy of my father's book, The Affluent Society, in Greek. And there are two things about that. One is that this is a book that he dedicated in part to me when I was 6 years old. And the other is that this particular copy is bound in a very special way. It is bound with used matchsticks, carefully assembled in layers and held together with a handmade varnish. And this was done in prison by three professors of economics here in Greece. And when they were released, when democracy returned, they gave it to my father and they signed it to a friend of democracy from three Greek Democrats. And I have that book. I'm here by chance and by choice. I came to Thessaloniki in part to give an interview today at ERT3. Events have conspired to lend rather more weight to the occasion than I expected. So be it. It is simply an honor for me to be here, to stand with you in the defense of a fundamental principle of democracy, and also to act and speak in my father's tradition in this particular way. Yanis has already given you a very complete and complex picture of the economic events. I think what I should do is to concentrate on the broad outline, just to sketch for you what seemed to me to be the most fundamental facts and the direction in which they point. First, very basic fact, is that this crisis has been going on for 5 years. That's a long time. That's longer than the United States was in the Second World War, longer than the period of the Great Depression before the election of Franklin Roosevelt. It's a long time. This has been 5 years of promises that things would get better. 5 years of forecasts that growth would resume. 5 years of disappointment. 5 years of failure. Can anybody question or deny this? I don't think so. So, after a certain amount of time, even an economist ought to reconsider their ideas. Most other people would do so much more quickly, but we are a very patient and stubborn profession. What was the view? The view that was propagated at the time of the crisis was that there was a series of national problems. In the United States, the subprime mortgage disaster. In Greece, overspending, undertaxing. In Ireland, commercial real estate. In Spain, residential housing, a bubble. And somehow all of these things seem to come to a head and break out in a crisis at the same time. What a coincidence. The crisis was to be corrected by national policies at national scale, by the actions of national governments. What policies? Well, the policies were to be the policies they were told to adopt, which in every case was approximately the same. Cut your public sector, raise your taxes, deregulate your markets, privatize, that is, the new Moses and his prophets. But while the policy was interpreted by authority, the judgment would be rendered by markets. Good behavior, effective action would bring back confidence. You must have heard this 1,000 times. And confidence would mean interest rates would fall and the credit markets would open. Okay? That was the sequence of events. And if that didn't happen, well, there was always an explanation, which was an inadequate degree of zeal. The failure of the policy could always be remedied by making the policy even more harsh. And there's always something else to cut. This is the attitude of the gambler who loses every hand he plays and comes back and doubles his bet. That's what we're seeing. You can keep that game going for quite some time. You may perhaps be familiar with a phrase attributed to Albert Einstein. I'm not sure that he said it, but it's almost good enough to be worthy of him, which is that insanity consists in always doing the same thing and expecting a different result. Now, from the beginning, there was a different view. It wasn't very widely held, except in some circles here present and our friends and closest colleagues, but it existed. This view held that the central fact of the crisis was the worldwide collapse of a model of growth fueled by private credit markets. It seems obvious that this was the case. How could it not be? Everything happened at once. Yes, the collapse originated with the debacle of the US mortgage markets, whose losses had been spread all through Europe by the sale of toxic securities to pension funds and townships and private investors and banks. And Europe and the United States are the same investment community. They react in the same way when they see a disaster, which is they run for safety. So of course they sold all the weak assets, the sovereign credits of the small countries, and bought the sovereign debts of the big countries. And the interest rates go up on one and down on the other. It's as obvious as anything in front of your eyes. Did the interest rates on United States debt go up because the US had a mortgage crisis? No, they went down. It was a massive worldwide flight to safety. Now, in Europe, this was especially aggravated by institutions that were inadequate to the purpose, that had been badly designed in many ways by my generation of economists 30 years ago, in a moment when certain ideas were in fashion, that held that, well, you know, the principles, that everything would be all right if the central bank simply controlled inflation and if all budgets were balanced and all markets were private. A set of ideas which for a decade have been receding around the world, abandoned in Latin America, never adopted in Asia, but still intensely held and advanced by those who were and had become committed to them many years ago. And on top of that, an attitude toward policy which was basically the mentality of a debt collection agency. A mentality of punishment, of debtors, reward for creditors, that fails to recognize the elementary truth that you can't have one without the other. That every surplus has a deficit corresponding. So this idea, alternative idea, that this was the problem, a worldwide collapse of private credit met by inadequate institutions and hidebound ideas, existed. And 5 years have gone by, and we can ask, which interpretation holds up better? And we have cases that we can look at. And in particular, and I'm not one to be a booster of the American experience, but we can compare the United States and Europe. And we can see that, as Yanis already said, in the United States, although there are many problems that remain, unemployment, foreclosures, stagnation, the situation is fundamentally stable. It has stabilized. It stabilized some time ago. Whereas in Europe, it has not. In Europe, the crisis just gets deeper and deeper. And why is that? It is not because the United States instituted and followed a policy of rigorous austerity. It is precisely because we did not. Right? And I'm not speaking, yes, we had an expansion package initially in 2009. That was important. But it was not the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing was that there exist in the United States stabilizing institutions that continued to function, that buffered the enormous losses that people suffered in the crisis. What were those institutions? Yes, we propped up the banks. I'm not particularly proud of that. But that wasn't the important thing. One of the most important things was that we had that the social insurance mechanisms worked. Social Security payments went up. Unemployment insurance applied across the whole country. The health insurance programs, which only applied a part of the population, but nevertheless an important part, continued to function. Disability payments picked up part of the people who had lost their jobs. Food stamps, very important program. Yanis has already spoken to this. Food stamps were expanded to cover about 70 million Americans today. 70 million, a very large share of the population. And all of these things meant that while losses were felt, they were not catastrophic to the society as a whole. And there's one other thing, almost equally important, and that has to do with debts. It's just a question of a difference of circumstance. In the United States, the debts that were at the root of the crisis were primarily household debts, mortgage debts, credit card debts, but especially mortgage debts. And a mortgage debt, over time, one of two things is going to happen. It will be paid, or it will default. Right? And defaulting is a very hard thing, but it gets rid of the debt. It gets rid of the debt. And so the debt burden goes down over time. That's not the case in Europe. In Europe, the problem is public debts, sovereign debts. And they are perpetual until they are renegotiated or repudiated. But that, again, is a drastic measure. Renegotiated. The resolution, in other words, has to be an active, not a passive process. It's plain as day. What are the implications? And again, I'm speaking very briefly here, so I'm really coming to the close of these very short remarks. I think the implications, and I'm entirely agreed with Yanis Varoufakis, that there must be a European solution. And it must begin with an assessment and a change of ideas. That's the most important thing. When ideas change, everything else will follow. Policies will follow. And as needed, institutions will follow after that. Now we have the benefit of the Varoufakis Holland modest proposal, a great many elements of which don't require changing the European institutions, could be done under current treaty framework. That's a very strong point, because it makes it easier if you could ever get agreement to get action. What are those things? Here I simply recapitulate what Yanis has already said. First of all, mutualize the debts and reduce the burden so that we are not working under the pretense that debts that cannot be paid will be paid. They won't be paid. If the burden of those debts is reduced, they are effectively made the common in large part the common responsibility of the European community, then they may become manageable. Without that, the losses are there in any event. Second point, restructuring the banks. We have to recognize that the model of growth that relied principally on the financial system to generate credits is gone. It's not coming back. And having large banking institutions that persist unchanged, for what point? For what purpose? What do they do? What purpose do they serve? What social function justifies their charters? If we had a smaller financial sector, we have a larger employment sector. If the profits are not being drained to the big bankers, they can go to the small businesses. Why is that not a reasonable policy change, both in the United States and Europe? And in the United States, it's a massive issue. Third point, release funding for investment and jobs. And here the mechanisms, again, have been outlined very effectively, I think, in Yanis's work. Using existing institutions, European Investment Bank, to begin a process of reconstruction and reemployment. Institutions at the continental level can do things that institutions at the national level cannot do. And then there is a fourth point, which to my mind becomes increasingly pressing as time goes on. It's a point which really speaks to the question of whether Europe means anything, as it would speak to the question of whether America means anything. In fact, it did speak to the question of whether America meant anything in the 1930s, when we also faced a crisis that threatened national, economic, and political existence. Let us recognize that our most pressing task is not to restore economic growth. It's not to bring us back to some past level of prosperity. We're very far beyond that. We are facing the threat of dissolution of great nations and social communities. It is an urgent matter to prevent that from happening. Stabilization, therefore, of society, stabilization of the human condition, has a very important role to play in what we must do. That means stabilizing people's pensions, right? Stabilizing unemployment insurance, stabilizing the basic services, education and health care, ensuring adequately bank deposits so as to prevent the cataclysm of an uncontrolled run and shutdown of the payment system. These are things we do for each other, mainly with a device that's called insurance. Social insurance, deposit insurance, health insurance, unemployment insurance. And when we extend that to the whole community, and by this I mean the European community or the American community, we bring our populations together and stop the processes that are driving them apart. So it seems to me that the objective to articulate is really a very simple one for the time being. It is to stop now the path of destruction, to stabilize now, to quell panic, to defeat violence, to buy time, frankly, not to solve all problems at once, but to buy time so as to effectively open up the possibility for a new politics. A new politics based on principles that are not foreign in Europe, not foreign in any part of Europe, not certainly foreign in Germany at all, but that have been forgotten and submerged in recent years. The principles, basically, of solidarity, and in a spirit of true and effective democracy. If we can do these things, perhaps we can begin to face together on a European basis, but also as an American, I should say, on a transatlantic basis, on the basis of our joint values and objectives, the very large and challenging problems that we will continue to face once we have turned a corner, changed our ideas, changed our policies, and brought this crisis finally and at long last to an end. I just want to say thank you very, very much for the opportunity to speak to you this evening.
Grazie.